You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. It's Friday, time for our reporter roundtable, where we break down all the news that made headlines this week around our region. Joining me live in studio are Rebecca Boone with the Associated Press of Idaho, Kevin Richard with Idaho Education News, and James Dawson, our legislative reporter here at Boise State Public Radio News. Welcome to the program.
Hello.
Thanks for having us.
So, big news on the Medicaid expansion front. Earlier this week, we spoke with Reclaim Idaho representatives right here on Idaho Matters about the rally that they held at the State House on Monday, and they came on the program Tuesday. I believe by Tuesday evening, the Idaho Supreme Court had weighed in on their ruling. So, Jimmy, get us up to date about why they had they listened to arguments and then their ruling.
Yeah, so the Idaho Freedom Foundation had sued quickly after the voters did approve Proposition 2 by about 61% or so. And they were arguing basically that this is going to tie Idaho lawmakers' hands in any future decision making that they could potentially do with Medicaid, right? So that was pretty much their argument. And the Supreme Court came down 3-2 voting that Medicaid expansion, in fact, was constitutional. The other two justices, let's see, Robin Brody and Gregory Mueller, dissented. They said that the suit should have been dismissed on technicalities, but they did not want to rule on whether it was constitutional or not. Mm. They said that they wanted to take a practice of judicial restraint and let it kind of go through the lawmaking process before they even touched it.
So at this point, since they ruled on it, what is the next step?
Well, the next step right now, it is the law of the land since it was declared constitutional. Right now, the Department of Health and Welfare needs to submit all the paperwork to the federal government, and then the Idaho legislature needs to fund it, not fund it. They can choose to do either. And then they can also apply for a federal waiver for any kind of restrictions that they might want, whether that's work requirements, co-pays, premiums, things like that.
It was interesting when Luke Mayville, who was part of Reclaim Idaho, was one of the people really pushing this. When he was on the program earlier this week, I asked him about the Supreme Court ruling because at that point it hadn't come down yet. And from Reclaim Idaho's standpoint, they said, you know, they were looking forward to what the Supreme Court ruling was in the sense that if they voted that it's constitutional, this is the law of the land.
Right. Yeah, and I spoke with him that night. He was pretty excited. So was Emily Strizich, another co-founder of Reclaim Idaho. They view this as a pretty big victory, and they think that the situation here is a little bit different than it is in Utah, which this week has been pretty much fast-tracking these restrictions to tack on to their Medicaid expansion. They see that, you know, a vast majority of legislative districts here voted in favor of Proposition 2, and they just think that it was a much more grassroots effort. At least that's what they tell me. Whether or not that shakes out is different, but they think that the circumstances here are different than in Utah and that it might be a little more trickier for anyone to tack on these restrictions.
And Kevin, just from a budget standpoint, when something like this happens, I mean, we had lawmakers right here on this program throughout the last, you know, 8 months who have said that they just don't have the money to fund something like this. But so how does that work from a budgeting standpoint?
Well, I think it's important to remember that, first of all, Governor Little's budget request for the Medicaid expansion does not involve using any general fund money for the next, you know, into the next year. I mean, you wouldn't implement Medicaid expansion until January, and you would use a combination of other funding sources to avoid a hit on the general fund budget. But I do think you've probably got legislators who are worried about what happens beyond 2020 and what sort of budget implications may lay in wait when this is fully implemented and when the state does have to pick up a share of the Medicaid costs.
So from one lawsuit to another, Rebecca, talk to us about what's going on with a lawsuit with the Idaho Department of Correction. And this has to do with not disclosing information about lethal injections?
Right. So there's a University of Idaho professor named Eliza Cover who filed a records request in 2017 asking
Yeah, we've documents. Had her on the program, right.
Right.
Yeah,
so she's been asking for documents involving where the state's getting its lethal injection drugs. how old they are, where they're coming from, all sorts of things like that that might pertain to how, you know, whether the source is ethical or has run into any trouble with the law for compounding pharmacies particularly, whether they were expired or not, how much we paid for them as a state. And it's, she's interested because she studies the death penalty and how the public sort of interacts with the death penalty. Mm-hmm. Well, the Department of Correction largely denied her request. In fact, at first, they just sent her a manual, like a policy manual on how the state administers the death penalty. And so she sued. And once she filed the lawsuit, the state started releasing more and more documents because they took sort of a deeper look in their basement and offices and things and kept finding more documents. So this has been going on in court. Ms. Cover and her attorneys with the ACLU say the state's record keeping was shoddy, you know, basically that they acted in bad faith, that they didn't even try to look for these records, that they had a habit of giving some records to some people who requested and some records to other people who requested. And they even allege that the state kept separate sets of financial books so that they could have one they would give the public showing a lower cost of the death penalty and then one that they kept that showed the actual cost. Now, the state has strongly denied that allegation. But they acknowledge they've had a lot of problems with their records retention and finding these records, like making sure that they have all the documents. So right now, a judge is deliberating and she'll make a ruling hopefully within the next couple of months. And we'll find out whether the state has to turn over those records or not. The state doesn't want to turn them over because they say if they give up the name of their source for lethal injection drugs, just the source that they used in the past, they don't currently have a source, that people won't want to sell to them anymore because the public will protest.
But do they have to give up the name versus giving up the information? Is there a difference in that?
Well, they argue that there is. But the ACLU says, look, we can't, you know, some compounding pharmacies that create these drugs have been in trouble. Mm-hmm. Regulatory trouble.
And we've seen that.
Right. Some states have actually tried to get drugs sort of smuggled into the country mm-hmm. from India or from other otherwise illegal sources. Mm-hmm. So really, the who that gives it to you, the ACLU says, is just as important as the what they're actually giving you.
Because then it goes down to should you be using a pharmacy that's already been had violations, because we saw this a couple of years ago across the country.
Right.
With that.
And when the drugs are bad, lethal injections go really wrong. I mean, inmates spend a really long time dying, and mm-hmm. there's arguments in court all the time that that method is inhumane. And as a matter of fact, in Tennessee, we've had death row inmates who have opted for the electric chair because they were too frightened about how lethal right. injection would go.
And then how does this work, though, about public records requests, potentially? And Jimmy, you, in your line of work, you do a lot of that. So if the ruling comes down, against this attorney, what does that do for asking potentially for public records requests? And I mean, can anyone deny them then?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't try to speak to what the potential ramifications are, at least from that specific agency. But it seems like it could give them more cover, at least when it comes to death penalty. It really depends on how narrowly it's tailored. I would assume that it should probably be, I don't know, tailored fairly closely to this specific case and not just public records in general. So it would probably just pertain to whether or not they're going to even release who gave them the drugs, mm-hmm. how much they paid for them, and what the drugs are.
So in the Board of Correction does have an exemption in the Idaho State Public Records Act that says that they can withhold information that they feel would put the ability to perform the death penalty in danger, but they have to weigh that with the public interest in the information. And so the ACLU says they didn't do any of that weighing in this situation. And the judge has said, because it appears that they did not,
it's
she
up to
has
her.
To do that weighing. So
oh,
now
okay.
she will deliberate and weigh the public interest
versus
whether it would prevent the state or not. What's the state interest in keeping that information? Mm.
And you know what's interesting about this? When was the last time we even had an execution in the state of Iowa? It's been a while.
2012. So we the state executed Paul Ezra Rhodes in 2011,
right.
And then the following year, Richard Albert Levitt.
So we're going on 7 years.
Right. But, I mean, we don't execute a lot of people
no, we
as
don't.
A state, because the previous one was in 1994. And
right.
then before that, it was like
I think the decades before that. So, Kevin, get us updated. Talk to us about what's going on with the Idaho Education Association.
Mm-hmm. Well, what you've had happen is a pretty nasty dispute going public here just in the past few days. So Sue Wigdorsky had been the union's executive director, hired staffer who'd been with the association for 20 plus years. She left back in October, and it was never really explained what the circumstances were. Well, she came out with a letter to the entire board of the union a couple of weeks ago with a series of allegations involving the president of the union, who is elected by membership. Carrie Overall is the president of the IAA. A series of allegations that basically revolve around improper communications with staff, improper communications with a member of the State Department of Education staff, communications that she says compromise the IAA's position on issues. The IAA is denying everything. They issued a blanket denial defending Overall and suggesting that they will pursue whatever avenues necessary to defend her reputation and the reputation of the union. So you read between the lines there, the union is taking this letter pretty seriously and is threatening to take further action. Why does all of this matter, and why is this so interesting? The IAA is one of the most prominent education lobbying groups in the state. They represent the majority of the state's teachers are members of the union. We don't know the exact numbers, but this is the largest teachers union in the state by far, and one of the most prominent lobbying groups in the state. Back when they were both working together, Wigdorsky and Overall pretty much represented the public face of the Idaho Education Association at the State House, at the legislature. The letter from Wigdorsky suggests that this is a very dysfunctional and discordant relationship going on behind the scenes. So it's a fascinating issue. It's a fascinating dispute that went public, and I doubt we've heard the last of it.
And it's fascinating that it went public.
It's very rare for any ex-employee to send this kind of a letter to a governing board with this level of serious allegations. And I have to emphasize that at this point, those are just allegations, and they're not corroborated. Wigdorsky didn't talk to me this week. She declined an interview request. And I asked her for corroborating documents, and I never did hear back.
And you did write an article about it. So if people want to go more in depth, I know that it's on Idaho.
The article is online at idahoednews.org.
We are continuing our Friday Reporter Roundtable. My guest today, Kevin Richert with Idaho Education News, Rebecca Boone with Associated Press of Idaho, and James Dawson, the legislative reporter for Boise State Public Radio News. Kevin, let's talk more about education, because we have discussed this issue, but we've never known a lot about it, and that is the education funding formula.
Well, we have a bill. The bill was released last week in draft form, and you had a listening session at the State House on Thursday afternoon where education groups and school administrators were able to weigh in. And you heard some recurring themes, and a lot of them were very technical in terms of concerns about the mechanics of this extremely complex 59-page bill that would redraw the way school funding is distributed. And we're talking about, depending on how much money you throw into this formula, upwards of $2 billion could be distributed in a whole different way. My takeaway out of all of this, as I heard the listening session, is that you've got so many concerns right now from educators, from education leaders. Even State Superintendent Sherry Ibarra didn't say she opposed or supported the bill, but raised a list of technical concerns and substantive concerns about the way this would work. I'm not sure at this stage of the game how this bill makes its way through the legislative process. We're into the first week of February. Dean Mortimer, who chairs the Senate Education Committee, said that he thinks it's probably about 2 weeks before this will be a bill that's ready to introduce in his committee. And then you've got to go through that committee. You've got to go through a full hearing. You have to get it through the Senate on the floor, which could be difficult. Then you have to do the whole process on the House side. It's odd to say because the legislature just started a month ago yesterday, but time is starting to get tight, especially for a bill this complicated, this far-reaching, this controversial. I mean, legislators are probably trying to get their heads wrapped around this if they haven't been dealing with this issue for 3 years, like some of the members of the committee that's been trying to do this. if you've got legislators who are trying to make sense of this bill and they're hearing from local educators who have concerns, this has a real uphill fight ahead.
And also, it has been, 20 plus years since we've had a funding formula?
It's been 25 years since the state redid its funding formula. And it's always important to remember that when the legislature did that 25 years ago, the other thing they did, they increased public school spending by 17%. Nobody's talking about a 17% funding increase. And when you put a lot of money into a formula, it's funny how the numbers tend to work out a little bit better and go a little bit more smoothly for everybody. That's the big concern, is that depending on what kind of money, how many dollars you put into this formula, there are going to be winners and losers. And what happens to those schools and those districts and those charters in the interim, and what happens long term?
And when it comes to the winners and the losers, when you were in that listening session, I mean, to look at how it is right at this moment, who would win and who would potentially lose?
You know, it's really complicated in terms of the formula, and that changes almost on a daily basis. And that maybe is part of the rub, too, is that if you've massaged the formula to take care of a district like Orofino, which had figured to lose a lot of money under the formula, if you massage the formula to fix Orofino's situation, well, you know, it's like, you know, squeezing a balloon, right? You know, the pressure moves to a different place. Yeah, that's why this is such a complicated issue, and why I think it's going to be such a difficult vote for legislators as they try to figure out, you know, what to do with this.
And Jimmy, another thing going on in the legislature right now, and we've talked about this quite a bit on the program. We've had Representative Elena Rubel on talking about this, is mandatory minimum sentences. And she has been doing a big push to get some of this changed.
Right. And this is the same bill as last year. House committee passed it out earlier this week. Basically, what it would do is it would let judges in certain drug trafficking cases, choose whether or not they want to, you know, really adhere to these minimum mandatory sentences. For example, let's say you have between a pound and 5 pounds of weed, that's a year in jail or prison automatically. If you have 2 grams of heroin, 3 years, not to mention the fines that go along with it. Judges would have to figure out two different circumstances. They would have to figure out whether it would cause an injustice if this mandatory minimum sentence would cause a, quote, manifest injustice, or if public safety would be at risk if they didn't follow that guideline. So it did pass out of the House committee. It's worth noting that it also passed the House pretty easily last year, too, and then it just got bottled up in a Senate committee.
So what's the feel at the State House this year regarding that, since we're kind of in the same place we were last year?
As far as I can tell, the House seems to be pretty much in similar places, but the Senate's still kind of a wild card right now. They talked about this in the committee hearing. They spent the first month of the legislature trying to convince their opponents, but it's still kind of unclear. Last year, prosecutors and law enforcement lobbying groups came out against it pretty heavily, saying, you know, these mandatory minimum sentences are really what's holding back people from bringing drugs into Idaho. Meanwhile, it was a couple days worth of testimony in this committee hearing in the House, and you had family members of drug addicts come in and say, you know, the 2 grams of heroin that will trigger this mandatory minimum, you know, that's what my son or daughter or, you know, brother, husband, you name it, that's what they use in a few days. And that's really the root of what Representative Rubel and Zollinger are trying to address here.
Well, and we should note that because it is for drug trafficking, that actually we have to define that and what that means in the state of Idaho, because when you think trafficking, I think we all think of it being moved and selling it. It is actually possessing it.
It could be, yeah, exactly, possessing it, but you could also be in the act of trying to sell it. So it's a pretty broad definition right now as it's written.
So we just have to wait to see where this goes then at this point. I mean, there's been movement, but...
Yeah, we'll kind of see. It's one of those wait and see approaches, yeah. I guess.
Rebecca, what's going on with... There's an inmate who's been on death row for 30 years here in Idaho. And get us updated on this, because the person's mentally ill. They're not going to get better. So there's all kinds of issues coming into play here.
Right. So David Leslie Card was sent to death row for killing two people. He shot them to death in Nampa as they were folding newspapers for delivery outside a convenience store. His attorney argued at the time that he was schizophrenic and so probably wasn't in his right mind. And he actually had to be treated to be able to stand trial, to be able to assist his own attorneys during his original trial. Well, he was convicted. He was sent to death row. Death row is always a solitary confinement situation. It's not like they get to share time with other people, really, other than the staffers who are delivering their food or whatnot. And he has been refusing medication to treat his illness while on death row for years and years and years. And since at least 2006, doctors hired by both the state and Mr. Card's attorneys have said, look, he's refused the medication for so long, he cannot be made well anymore. He's, even if he were to be treated, he would not make a full recovery. That's an issue because he has appeals still pending on his sentence, and he has to be able to assist his attorneys in those appeals for the due process requirement to be met, right? You can't If you can't help your attorneys because you're too mentally ill, you can't get a fair trial under how we run our justice system. So his case has been stayed. So, you know, his appeals have been stayed because he can't help his attorneys. And they've been stayed since 2006 or so. And what happened this week was this: the state finally said, we're not even going to try anymore. We're not going to try to execute this guy. We are fine if even if he gets well enough in his gets treated so that he's well enough to help his attorneys on his appeals, and we end up resentencing him again, we will only seek life in prison without parole. It's just he can't be executed if he's not well. He can't finish his appeals to be executed if he's not well. So the state has finally said, look, life in prison is enough for us.
And so that's where it's at.
So that's where it's at.
Okay. Kevin, I want to get back to the funding formula for a minute because I didn't ask this question. Because time is running short, like you said, and it's such a big bill, and because it's been 25 years, there are lawmakers who have never even dealt with an issue like this. So where do you think this is going to roll over to something next year, or will they even come to a decision on this?
Well, you know, it was funny. During the hearing, you had not only legislators, but you had education leaders talk about the last really big and complicated education issue that the legislature resolved, and that's the career ladder. That's the five-year plan to raise teacher salaries. And what you heard several people say is that was a very difficult process. Probably this is more difficult and more complicated legislation than the career ladder. But what you had with the career ladder, you had several drafts of the bill that weren't popular. You had the third draft of the bill that everybody kind of got behind, and it passed the legislature at that point fairly quickly. But what I see happening here is that I don't see as much of a consensus behind this concept of redrawing the school funding formula. So you've got something that's much more complicated, has much greater implications, and I just have a hard time seeing where there's going to be consensus among the education groups to try to do something in the next few weeks. And you know, we're at a point where the legislature is hoping to try to move towards adjournment. There, you know, the budget committee is going to start to write budget bills here in the next couple of weeks, including the public school budget. So my guess is that there may get to a point in the session where lawmakers say that this is just too big, it's too complicated, we weren't going to implement it anyway, we were just going to pass a bill and implement it the following year. This, you know, I think there's a very good chance that it just gets kicked down the road for another year.
I want to thank all of you for coming in today for our reporter roundtable. My guest, Kevin Richert with Idaho Education News, Rebecca Boone with the Associated Press of Idaho, and James Dawson, reporter for Boise State Public Radio News. Thanks so much, guys.
Thanks.
Thank you.